James Vincent McMurrow used lockdown to reflect on his life and rework his new album, Grapefruit Season, which is released this Friday. His first album since he signed to the major label, Columbia Records, was recorded between London, Los Angeles and Dublin, largely before the pandemic struck. James Vincent Rowell also made headlines in July, playing the first concert in Ireland for quite some time that had a live audience. Tickets for that pilot gig selling out in just 30 seconds, we'll all remember. Delighted to be joined by James Vincent McMurrow this evening on the programme. I love, James, the reason for the title here, Grapefruit Season, and your poor mother. Could you not let it go? Tell us why your mother inspired the title for the album.
Well, I mean, first of all, hi, how are you? When I was a kid, used to eat grapefruit a lot. And it always, I never understood it because I never liked grapefruit. I don't like the taste of it. And I always questioned it when I was a kid. Like, why wouldn't you eat things that are just delicious or like really good and tasty all the time? And then when I started touring, I found myself starting to eat it because the touring lifestyle, like you're on a tour bus all day, every day, and you don't get any sleep. It's quite unhealthy. So I just started doing all these things that people just told me were healthy. And one of them was eating grapefruit. And it just made me think back to when my mom used to eat it. And I guess I got taken with the idea of the things that we add to our lives as we move through life to try and make ourselves feel better. And like the sort of pressure, I guess, to a degree that I felt just as a human being and also as a musician to kind of add things to my life to try and make myself feel a certain way, feel like a grown up, feel responsible, all these different things. And grapefruit just sort of became like the avatar for it all. And it all started with my mom when I was a kid, just eating it every day. Yeah.
She ate it every day. It wasn't that she went on a diet every so often and grapefruit was the staple
food. She hate me talking about her diet, but she did, that was the thing too. It was like the grapefruit diet and just all these different things that she used to do. And I just thought it was an interesting sort of like image. I always get this like a very specific image in my head when I start making a record or starts coming into focus. And that was just the one that was what stuck with me.
Your mother eating grapefruit. Yeah. You do know you're going to have a long conversation with her tonight and a big apology now that you've shared all
holidays. Hopefully she's not listening. Like, she's not like, are you talking about me on the radio again? No, she's fine.
No, it's okay. I'll send her a link. Don't you worry.
We'll make sure she
gets it.
Thank you.
At any rate, I wonder then to what extent was the COVID period and that period of absolutely no gigs, was it like one long grapefruit diet in some ways?
Yeah, and you know what, like even within there, I did a lot of I did juice cleanses and like a lot of manic behavior. I think I'm imagining that's pretty relatable, like people listening, that like there was a lot of things I did to just kind of give myself moments of feeling better or feeling in control. Because, like, I don't know, like, I can only speak to my world and my environment, but, like, as a musician, I've spent so much of my life in control of my own destiny, or, like, aware of the fact that I was the one that needed to control it. Like, if I wanted to succeed, I needed to get up every morning, go play that show, if it was in front of 20 people or 2,000 or 3,000, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then all that gets taken away and you just wake up every morning and you've nothing to do and nothing to define you for better or worse as a human being, apart from like just, you know, you existing in your house with the people that you spend all your time with.
How big a sigh of relief did you breathe then when the gig came along in July? I know it was just a pilot gig and that it was only the start of things, but was it a good feeling around that? At least, here we go, at least an audience to play to.
Yeah, again, I think there was, in retrospect, quite a manic energy around it all because we were all just so desperate. Like, I think the level of desperation that sort of has came off of us was like almost physical because it just not really having that in your life, not realizing what you've lost until it's gone. I know that's kind of a cliche, but I take so much for granted and shows were one of them. I'll get to play a show again whenever I want and then that gets taken away. So that show became like, again, almost like an avatar for like our hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
Probably too much in hindsight, but at the time, it really felt quite earnest on our behalf that we were just like, yes, let's do this. And I felt a great amount of pride in giving my team, I guess, a job to do and a sense of purpose again.
Let's have a listen to something off the new album. You describe this song, I'm just going to play a bit of True Love. You describe it as a pocket of light for you in 2020. Let's have a listen to a little bit of what the pocket of light inspired in you.
True love, you must be. True love,
True Love, a little bit of a track there from James Vincent McMurray's new album, Grapefruit Season. I'll eat a lot of grapefruit if it'll help me to write a song like that, James.
Thank you. Appreciate that, man.
Well, tell us a little bit. I mean, was there a specific moment that kind of started that song, or how did it come about? It really, there's such an emotional core, a really strong emotional core to it.
Well, I mean, on a general level, anyone that's aware of, I mean, you know, we're in Ireland, I guess people are pretty aware of my records through the years and I guess the evolution of it. When I started, I was a very anxious person. Like, I'm not well built for a lot of parts of being a musician. So when it came time to writing songs and putting them in the world, I think I worked really, really hard to try and create like a mythology around it that I could feed myself into without having to go and then speak. So I found a lot of metaphors for saying the things I wanted to say. When it came time to this album, I realized that over the last 3 or 4 records, I've kind of moved into a space where I'm trying, at least earnestly, to be more honest and not grandiose, to try and find a succinct way to make a thought and to say it. And with this song, like, I had that first lyric, "The bright lights when I see you." And that just felt really like honest to me in the terms of like, you know, my relationship with the person that I love. And I really liked that idea. But I'm also aware that like with the wrong iteration and in the wrong hands, it can be a very kind of cheesy trope to deploy. So like the idea of true love as the hook of a song. So I spent a lot of time trying to find a route through it that was earnest and like clever, I guess, to a degree. I started it in Miami. Like, you made me saying at the start, like a jet setter, like the album recorded in LA and all these different places. And now I'm talking about writing songs in hotels in Miami. But that was just where I started writing it. Yeah. And then I sat on it for like 2-3 years and then finished it last year. Like, once lockdown kicked in, kind of gave me time and energy to kind of hone in on a way through it.
And I know Lil Silva, one of the producers on the album, was very, you know, was very helpful in terms of that song. Paul Epworth, of course, Grammy Oscar winning producer Paul Epworth from, you know, Adele. And others, he's involved in the album as well, and particularly on the opening track, Paradise, which I loved, really gets off to a great start. But I guess when you speak about true love in that fashion, I have to mention the arrival of your little girl, Margot. How has that changed things? Just the day-to-day schedule of your life, you know, in terms of trying to keep the music business going, and yet you have this bundle of joy and bundle of demand. it could be said right beside you.
Yeah, I mean, like it was interesting in the beginning because as a musician, you become quite self-oriented, like, you know, and also quite self-aware. Like, I'm definitely a very self-conscious person. Again, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. So when you have a kid, it 100% automatically straight off the bat becomes not about you, where you have to take care of this person, whatever that means, whatever that entails in the moment. You can't think about yourself. And I know that me personally, as the person that I was versus the person that I ultimately would like to be in life, I definitely needed that. I definitely needed something to pull me out of like my egotistical wormhole and make me more of a whole person. Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, like there's a really good Kate Bush documentary. And I remember hearing her talk about why she stepped away from music. And she said that she was a caricature of a person, that she wanted to be a whole, well-rounded person. And I've always resonated. I just love that idea. And I think it's so true. It's just a world of sort of caricature in the music industry. And it's beautiful and fruitful. But I wanted to be a whole person. Yeah. So having a daughter and then her becoming like everything just really made me that person.
What age is she now, James?
She just turned 3.
3. Yeah, well, there you go.
Yes, half her life in a lockdown.
Listen, lovely to have spoken with you this evening. I do want to mention Don Conroy before we go, the album art. It must be lovely to have him involved in that and involved in the cover art for the album itself. But I want to finish up with, this is the first play, and thank you for giving us this, the very first play of Planes in the Sky, one of the tracks from the album. The album is released on Friday, but this hasn't been heard out. It hasn't been out there before. So will you give us a little lead into it, James?
This song is like, it's basically the song that I've been dreaming of writing for like my whole life. Just, I know I don't like the word groove, but like when people hear it, they know what I mean. It has a groove to it that like I would play until the end of my life, just over and over on the bass guitar. So I love this song. I really genuinely, I mean, you know, they're all my children, but I love this one particularly.
Great. Thanks for being with us this evening, James.
Absolute pleasure.
Yeah, you can hear the groove he's talking about there. James Vincent McMorrow, track called Planes in the Sky. First listen to that on Irish Radio, and thanks to James for giving us that. The latest album is called Grapefruit Season. His poor mother will never forgive him. The album is out this Friday. Formula One driver Michael Schumacher falls into the category of sports people who transcend the discipline they competed in. At the time of his second retirement in 2012, he held the record for the most championships, the most races won, the most pole positions achieved, and the most podium appearances secured. However, as you will all know, in 2013, his life took a tragic turn when he suffered a traumatic brain injury while skiing with his son in France. Ever since, his family and those around him are very protective of his privacy. Very little is actually known of his current condition. This week, Netflix is releasing a new documentary about his life, and his family are involved with the production. It's been released to coincide with the 30th anniversary of Schumacher's debut in Jordan with the Jordan team at the Belgian Grand Prix in August 1991. Damien O'Mara of RT Sport has been taking a look at the documentary for us. They're releasing this, really, Damien, Netflix, in the context of the huge success they've had with previous sports documentaries.
Yeah, sport has been big, big business for them over the last couple of years. I've become a regular visitor and delighted to be here to talk to you about Netflix sporting documentaries. So we've had like The Last Dance about Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls, which I think was the one that captured most people's imaginations. They've likewise done a retrospective on the life of Pelé between his debut World Cup and his final appearance in a World Cup. And it seems to just be one of those disciplines that lends itself brilliantly to the high production values that
Formula
Netflix
One.
Have.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sport in general, but yeah. Formula One in this case, that it's obviously a niche area that they identify, that they have the weight to put in the production that is required. And as well as that, a lot of these, they become almost career retrospectives or legacy projects for the people involved. And I think that's a large part of the appeal that Netflix have, this global entity that can reach into living rooms at the four corners of the world.
But in the case of Michael Schumacher, there's the extraordinary career, it has to be said, but then there's the accident in 2013, and I don't know what you were expecting, but I was wondering what the balance would be here between a retrospective of his career and finding out about him today.
I think there has certainly developed a morbid curiosity with his current condition. So you've touched on it in the introduction. In 2013, skiing holiday with his son, Michael Jr., who's now a Formula One driver, banged his head, had a helmet on. Doctor said had he not worn the helmet, he wouldn't be with us now. Suffered a traumatic brain injury. Virtually nothing is known of his current condition. It's alluded to towards the tail end of the documentary. And the family, his wife Karina, who we're going to talk about, is the star, the glue that holds this entire project together. They talk at one point about Michael isn't here and we miss Michael. And then they kind of allude to the fact that there's a new Michael, but we don't really know how he is. His wife talks at one point in the documentary about how one of his principal ambitions when he was at the height of his fame was to protect his family from the scrutiny. And they are now doing that in return. So you occasionally have stuff that filters into the media about a family friend said this, a source close to the Schumacher said that, but they themselves have said very little. I think there was an expectation that we would have found out a little bit more about the condition he's in. I don't know if that was something that perhaps was misinterpreted by some of the advanced publicity, because this has obviously been in production for quite some time. If you want to watch this to find out where Michael Schumacher is in 2021, you're not going to find that out.
Yeah, and if you want to find that out, I mean, it is a matter of privacy. I suppose there is a line that has to be drawn somewhere. And it's not as if the career hasn't plenty to tell us in and of itself. You know, you think of Formula One, you think of a lot of money, a lot of wealth and a lot of privilege. But he came from very, very humble background.
Yeah, he came from nowhere. And the documentary, it's 90% his Formula One career. We get flashbacks and we get family archive and we get an insight. His father features, his brother Ralph, who also drove for Jordan and drove in Formula One, features. This was a guy who came through karting. Parents balanced multiple jobs in order to allow Michael and his brother pursue their karting dream. And an aspect of his life that I never knew about was the fact that they would go to karting races and other drivers and other father and son combinations or whatever they would discard pieces of old equipment and pieces of tyres. And basically a large part of his success, he puts it down to the fact that I came through a karting career driving materials that everyone else had dumped, or materials that was slightly substandard based on what the pinnacle of the sport was at the time. And that was basically how he managed to get every last millisecond out of a car, because he had developed this tacit relationship with go-karts, largely put together from spare parts other people had discarded. It's fascinating.
There's a point too where he says something about why are you driving for Switzerland in this particular, it's only a go-kart race, but he said, because I don't have to pay money if we don't qualify. We'll automatically qualify for the next round, and I don't have to pay any money if we lose.
When you consider that you're in a situation, even still in Formula One, where Damien O'Mara might be a better driver than Sean Rocks, but Sean Rocks has multi-million euro more in sponsorship behind him, so you'll get the seat ahead of me. But here's a guy who literally came from not poverty, but certainly a working class background, you know, made it to the pinnacle of his sport.
However, I suppose it's when we get into the actual Formula One career that we get to the nuts and bolts of the documentary. There are two Michael Schumachers. Anybody who speaks about Michael, the guy, the fella whose house you go to, whose party you go to, he's a lovely fella.
Yeah.
Michael the driver is a totally different chap.
And they don't shy away from it. And very often this is a criticism of documentaries like this, particularly when the family or the individual themselves is so centrally involved. They don't gloss over the fact that he wasn't the nicest of people to deal with on the track. They talk an awful lot about his talent. They talk an awful lot about his dedication and how good he was, particularly when he's at Ferrari. He knew everyone's wife's name. He knew their kids' names. He knew everything about them. You didn't want to get into a row with him, and you didn't want to be the guy that was going to pip him to a world championship. They are very open in, he had multiple incidents. Like, for it to happen once is one thing. For it to happen on a couple of occasions, he took Damon Hill out of it with a world championship decider.
Let's listen to that particular. This was, if neither of them finished the race, then Schumacher was going to be the winner.
Schumacher
of this,
went in leading in the championship. Yeah.
So there was an incident. Let's listen to that incident and Damon Hill's description of it.
When we went round one of the corners, I saw him coming back on the track, and it looked like he'd just gone off and then came back on again, and I saw his car wobbling.
When I drove over to the left, I was doing a bit like this to check everything, clean off the tyres.
I saw an opportunity to go past, and I thought, I have to go.
Schumacher, look at Damon Hill and Schumacher. Oh, no, no!
In the moment I turned into the corner, it was Damon who hit me first on the sideboard.
And his car came back across and hit my car. And he went up on two wheels.
In the moment I was up in the air and then into the tyre was, so no, I couldn't understand it.
Oh, Alfred Schumacher! The German is out of the Australian Grand Prix, and Damon Hill only has to keep going to be world champion.
The point situation was very simple. He had a points advantage on me. If none of us finished, he'd be champion.
Damon Hill will have to go back to the pit.
I could see my suspension was broken, so I couldn't carry on. As a competitor, he was going to win come what may. Michael did what he had to do to stop me beating him.
Damon Hill very clear on what he thinks happened on that particular day.
Now, to be fair to Damon Hill, if you develop it on further, he goes, hang on, put me in the car in the same situation. Yes. What would I have done? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But like I said to you, it's for it to happen in 94 with Hill is one thing. For it to happen in, I think it was 97 with Jacques Villeneuve was another thing. That he had these moments where whether intentionally, I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily an invincibility complex. I think it's an infallibility complex that I can do this and there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, and somebody said, asked him at one stage, were you ever wrong? And he thinks for a long time and he says, I don't really ever remember being wrong.
That's the difference between him and
the
us.
The Ayrton Senna story, I mean, there's such tragedy in this because Ayrton Senna was ahead and was going to win and had a terrible accident, but Schumacher was right on his backside.
Yeah, so Imola in 94. So like you said, Schumacher comes into Formula 1 in 91. By 94, like, he has had this explosive start to his career and his former manager talks about it in the documentary, where a couple of years ago he had pictures of Senna on his wall. The next thing, he's challenged Senna for the World Championship literally a couple of years later. He was the car directly behind Senna at Imola in 94 when Senna went off at Tamburello and ended up having the crash, which ultimately cost him his life. it means that Schumacher was robbed of this great, well, the world was robbed of this, in terribly tragic circumstances, this great competition between Senna and Schumacher over the years. And Schumacher lost the man that was clearly his idol.
Yeah, and you hear him here in a press conference a number of years later.
1998.
When, yeah, so this is the point at which Schumacher has equaled Senna's number of wins, etc., etc. And he's in a press conference and he's asked about equaling that record.
This is your 41st victory, which puts you in equal second all-time with Ayrton Senna. Do those records mean a lot to you?
Yes, it does mean a lot to me. Sorry.
Thanks, Michael. Nick, for the last two races, Michael's been, I think, magnanimous enough to admit that on the day you had the faster car, the McLaren. Do you think today that Ferrari was just the faster car?
Can we have a break?
Mika Häkkinen at the end of that press conference trying to really stop it all. But Schumacher was absolutely... This was an ice-cool man who never broke down, who was as cool as a breeze.
Do you know, I think this is the point, and like David Coulthard features prominently at one point, and he is the one that really addresses the... You don't want to have to deal with Schumacher on the track, but away from the track, you go to his house, he's a great guy. I think this is one of the few occasions in a really public scenario where the world saw the real Schumacher, who was an emotive character and not the Iceman.
How good is this documentary? And I suppose we have to compare it to the Ayrton Senna scene if you just heard the Ayrton Senna documentary
Herein lies the challenge. It is a perfectly fine documentary. It is really well produced. But even talking to people as recently as sitting outside the studio before I came in, is it as good as Senna? And that's the question
that's the first question he's going to ask.
There's a couple of things in it that, like, it's brilliant. The archive is great. Formula One, as we've mentioned, the sound lends itself so brilliantly to this type of a medium. There's a few things in it that are missing. I would have liked to have heard more, not necessarily from his peers, but the people from whom he inherited the mantle. So your Prosts, your Nigel Mansells, that generation, that who he burst onto the scene in 91 and
changed
basically
everything,
blew away. It's really well made. He is the missing figure. And I would love to hear from himself if life was slightly different, where instead we're listening to Archive, which doesn't fully tell the Archive story. Is it a Senna? No. Is it worth watching? Probably if you're more of a Formula One fan, where Senna kind of spanned all the generations.
Yes, so Senna was a whole different, it was a big drama in and of itself. That's Demi O'Mara talking to us about Schumacher, the new Netflix documentary, will be available from September 15th. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. The stellar career of Mark Cousins as filmmaker and critic is based on his ability to see and to read all things visual. Since the success of his BBC film series Moviedrome, Cousins has made films exploring the art of filmmaking, drawing on exhaustive libraries of clips to create documentaries such as The Story of Film and Odyssey. And more recently, we spoke to him about his 14-hour-long documentary Women Make Film, A New Road Through Cinema. For someone whose career is based on looking, the fear that his eyesight might be in danger spurred Mark on to make a very personal film called Mark Cousins, The Story of Looking. Delighted to be joined by Mark on the programme this evening. Mark, the Story of Looking, which is also a book telling this aspect of your life, it draws on art history, it draws on poetry, it draws on film, it draws on all sorts of ideas and philosophies. But this really is a personal story, your own experience of looking or seeing. But it was an upcoming surgery, I think, that really, I suppose, stopped you in your tracks and made you take stock of everything and made this film happen.
Yes, you're right, Sean. The unexpected comes at you, doesn't it? Something out of left field. And the film that I made is about the things that you say about art history and things, but it's more about just looking at landscapes. And I remember growing up in Belfast and going to Donegal and the last landscapes of Donegal as a kid, and the hedgerows of Connemara as a kid and stuff like that. And though the emotion of that, the way you feel so relaxed in the world, that kind of stuff. So when I got a bad eye problem, then it made me rethink all that stuff in a very nice way.
You say in a very nice way, but it must have been quite frightening as well. For a filmmaker in particular, somebody who works in the world of visuals, for the eyesight to be the thing that is threatened, that, that might actually disappear, that can, that must have caused several dark nights of the soul.
It did cause several dark nights of the soul, you know, because that's your, that's my link to the world. You know, musicians, you know, use their ears and other people use different senses. But for me, my joy, my sadness, my sense of everyday life, my rapture comes from looking. And so when my left eye started to dim really, really quickly, I thought, oh no, is this the end of something? And I'm 56 now, and at that age, you start to notice that your joints are going a wee bit, and you start to think, oh, I'm on the way. Am I on the way out, or the way down, or something? And that was the feeling. There was a sadness that came with that.
The beginning of the film has a most arresting clip. It's an interview with the singer Ray Charles, famously blind from childhood, and here he's answering an interviewer's questions about what he misses by not being able to see. Let's have a listen.
If you were to say to me, look, I can wave a wand and you can see right now, and it's got to be a forever thing, I might would turn it down. If you were to say to me, well, I can wave it and you can see for maybe a day, I might accept that, only because there are a couple of things that maybe I would like to see once, you know, or, you know, just so that I really would know for what's really happening,
really?
That I haven't seen. Yeah, because, you know, as I said, you know, that I've seen the stars and the moon and the sun, and I remember my mother. So I think basically I would probably like to see, just for once, because I see them anyway all the time. Like, you know, like my kids, for instance, you know, just to physically see them. But actually, I'm not all that hung up about seeing things, because I do everything I want to do. I go everywhere I want to go. And with some of the news I hear about today, you know, I mean, there's some things I just absolutely don't want to see, man. I feel sorry for you guys who have to put up with it, you know.
Ray Charles there in an interview talking about what it is that doesn't bother him about not being able to see. In fact, Mark Cousins is with us this evening talking about his new film, The Story of Looking. And that clip is very much very close to the top of your film, Mark.
Yes.
What struck you about, I mean, there's so much in what he says there, really, isn't there?
It's amazing, isn't it, what he says? You know, I've seen the moon and the stars, and I've seen my mother. You know, wow. And I think when I first saw that, and I saw that many years ago and listened to him many years ago, and of course he's fantastic, I thought, yeah, he must be right. And then I realized that I think he's wrong. You know, another figure in my film is the great French painter Paul Cézanne, and he talks about, he in one of his letters, he talks about the optical experience developing within him. And he wrote that at the end of his life. And even at the end of his life, Paul Cézanne, the great painter, still realized that he was learning how to see. Mm. And Ray Charles makes it sound as if you see once, you see a glimpse of something, and then you've got it. And seeing is richer than that, and slower than that, and more evolving than that, and more life and enduring than that. So I feel that I'm still an amateur in the seeing business, and that's a lovely feeling.
Yeah, and not only, but in some ways, Richard says in the midst of that too, that he sees anyway. He's not talking about visual seeing the visuals, he's seeing with something else, with his mind's eye perhaps. And I found that aspect of what he says quite amazing as well. Has to be said, in the making of this film, Mark Cousins, you didn't get up and about too much, did you? You spent a fair amount of time in the old bed.
I just laid in my old bed. Yeah, no, I know. I've been a traveller in my past, as you know, Sean. I've made films around the world. And this one, I thought, do the opposite of what you expect. You expect to make when you make a film about visuals, then you jump on lots of planes. And I thought, what if I jump on no planes? What if I just lie in my bed and make toast and think? You know, it sounds very lazy, and I'm not a lazy guy, but I thought, you know, when you're creative, you're always looking to do the opposite of what's expected. And so that's what happens in this film. I lie in my bed and just remember the things that I've seen from around the world, and the movies that I've seen, and the people I've seen, and my dead granny, and all the stuff. You know, we've got such a rich inner life, and especially we were made aware of that in the COVID era, obviously.
Yeah.
How many visuals there are in our heads.
Yeah, and let us know, lest people think he wants me to watch him for an hour and a half in the bed holding an iPhone up in front of his face. No, we do get amazing archive footage from lots of different places and film clips in there as well, you know, where you compare things that are happening in real life to visuals in films, and some amazing little things that you bring in that respect. But there is also the whole question of the right to look, and artists and journalists, I suppose, from the beginning of time, have had accusations of objectifying at the, I suppose, at one end, exploiting even, one could say, at another end. I mean, you give us a glimpse at one stage of what we think is the beheading of a woman in the Middle East. I say you had to think long and hard about including shots like that.
I think so, yeah. You're right, Sean, you know, because looking can be, you know, intrusive, and we can, you know, if we are wealthy and European, we can stereotype how we see other people, you know, and so it's that we have a duty to look at hard stuff and terrible stuff, you know, in the 20th century, for example, or the Holocaust. We have the duty as citizens and voters to look at that stuff, but also we have to ask questions of what harm can looking do, what hurting can looking do, what social media can try to make people look them look thin and beautiful, etc. So there's definitely there's an ethics around that.
You also surprised me, I have to say, quite a bit when, you know, most people, you say the word selfie to them and they thought, more narcissism. The narcissism of the age is what we're dealing with there. You look at the selfie in a very different way, Mark.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that when people, through most of human history, it was only posh people, rich people who could make images of themselves. And now pretty much anyone can with their mobile phone, and the majority of selfies that are taken around the world every day, including today, are taken by women, and they're taken by people out with their mates. Look at me, here we are in the pub or on a holiday or something. And so selfies are expressions of joy, but not only joy and pleasure, they're mostly expressions of, look, I'm here, I'm in front of the Eiffel Tower, or I'm at the Giant's Causeway or wherever. And so I'm very optimistic about selfies. They're simply an affirmation of being alive, in my opinion.
Finally, Mark, how is the eyesight now? Very frightening, I would have thought, to go underneath the knife in the way that you did and the way that you show us. Is everything fine now, and will everything progress without further difficulty, or can you tell?
It's great. I'm happy to say, you know, I can see now. I see like a teenager now. My eyesight is super good.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that, and continued good looking at whatever it is you're looking at in the coming months and years. Thanks very much for being with us this evening, Mark.
Thanks, mate. Until the next time.
That's Mark Cousins, and he was talking to us about his film, The Story of Looking, which will be in cinemas across Ireland and with virtual screening partners from September 17th. It's perhaps inevitable with diagnoses of dementia on the increase in recent years that this should be reflected in the storylines of fiction, TV and film, from the soap Emmerdale to Avenue Dushy's Booker shortlisted novel Burnt Sugar and Florian Zeller's film The Father, which sees Anthony Hopkins in Oscar-winning form.
And you?
What?
Sorry to ask this, but I mean you, who are you?
I'm Catherine.
Catherine, that's right. Yes, Catherine. What about me? But who exactly am I?
You. You're Anthony.
Heartbreaking clip there from Florian Zeller's film, The Father. This Wednesday and Thursday, the Dementia Fiction Festival takes place in the Accidental Theatre in Belfast, in person and online. Its aim is to explore a range of issues arising from how dementia is represented on page and on screen. Its organisers, author Jan Carson and academic Jan Duchea, join me now on the line. Jane, to you first, while your build as the academic in terms of this Festival. Your interest in dementia fiction very much comes from a personal angle. Tell us a little bit about your own experience as a dementia caregiver.
Oh, that's right. I wouldn't necessarily call myself a caregiver, though. I think I'm come from the same place a lot of us do, in the sense that my life was just touched by it when a family member received a dementia diagnosis a few years back. In my case, it was my granny, and I have to give hats off to my auntie, who did most of her caring. But I wanted to know a bit more about what was going on with granny's diagnosis. So thankfully, the Alzheimer's Society, they provide training for informal caregivers. And I went to that, a 6-week course, really, really useful. But it struck me at the time that caregivers were advised to put themselves in the shoes of the person with dementia. And at the time, I scratched my head and wondered, how on earth do you do that? But luckily enough, in my other side of my life, my professional life, that's my academic expertise is on literary language and the effects it has on readers. And at that time, I was getting interested in how minds are represented in fiction. And so I began to read a bit more widely on how dementia is represented in fiction, in characters with dementia, and how their minds are played out on the page. And the two came together then in this project.
In this project, indeed. And indeed, Jan Carson, as Jane describes to us there, putting yourself into the shoes of a person with dementia. You've done that quite a lot in recent times because of your involvement with the festival. Over 100 books or thereabouts over the last 2 years exploring specifically the whole area of dementia. Did you go seeking them out?
Yes, I kind of began like a journey of seeking them out. And then I think as people heard this was a quest I was on, they began recommending things to me, particularly books from a kind of international context, things in translation, poetry, plays. There is a wealth of different texts which are exploring the dementia narrative out there. And I guess this festival is an opportunity to raise questions about how we do that in an ethical way, how we make sure we're including diverse voices, how we're telling these stories to children and young people. There's so many different avenues that we want to chat about.
And I suppose, you know, given the clip that I just played from the Florian's, which was a play, first of all, the father, and then his film with that Oscar-winning performance from Anthony Hopkins. Presumably that was one of the texts or one of the films that you looked at. What other books did you give us a sense of a kind of a breadth of the material you were reading and some of the ones that affected you more as you read them?
For me, so we were very focused in our research on 10 core texts. So some big ones you might have heard of, like Elizabeth is Missing and Still Alice. And then a few slightly more obscure ones, like a fantastic Dutch text called Out of Mind. I also looked slightly wider. So my remit took in not just novels, but reading the poetry, which I think actually our poets do a really good job of exploring dementia because they understand white space and what's not said maybe, and they often play with like confused language and things like that.
Yeah, and you mentioned Still Alice there, which also made it to the cinema screen with Julianne Moore playing that Alice character, and Elizabeth is Missing. With Glenda Jackson giving a stellar performance, an adaptation for the BBC, that particular piece. But interesting what you say about poetry, Jan, and maybe if I come back to you on that, Jane, there were different stages in this project, one of which was, or the starting point was what you refer to as mind style analysis. Yes. Maybe you could explain that to us in more layman's terms. And I think poetry might be quite useful in an explanation of that in many ways.
You could be right there. Mind style, as we tend to study it in my field, which is literary linguistics, is the representation of how the mind works or cognition, usually in fiction or in narrative, at least. It doesn't have to be fiction. It could be nonfiction. So it's that sense, and I'm sure all readers will be able to identify with it. If you read novels regularly, you know the feeling of when you're inside a character's mind. And that happens through language. It happens through the author being able to construct a mind out of out of literary discourse, out of language. And there are certain tricks for doing that. But the interesting thing about it is it tends to be that there are patterns in the language and they repeat themselves and they accumulate to make a way of thinking in a text. And everybody's familiar with it, but it's only really in my field that we try to describe exactly how that happens with language.
Yeah.
And we call that mind style.
As Jane describes it there, Jan Carson, it strikes me, you know, I know you don't want to get show the magician shouldn't show how the trick is done, as it were. But for you as a writer, I mean, it strikes me that trying to describe or trying to get inside the mind of a person with dementia gives a particular challenge in that you are talking about a mind that perhaps is breaking up or is fragmented in some way. Certainly the links that you would normally, the chain that you could normally link up in another character, they just don't exist in a character with dementia.
Well, I'll tell you something, Sean. It gives us a really good opportunity to think about appropriation, because particularly at the end of someone's journey with dementia, it's almost impossible for them to tell their own story. So it falls to a writer to make decisions about how they represent it. And I think it gives us a chance to think about the ethics of that. You know, how do we make sure that that story is as truthful and as engaging? And perhaps we can use those lessons to think about writing other experiences that we haven't had ourselves. So I'm really hoping some of the conversations we have this week will help other writers like myself who are wrestling with writing experiences we don't know.
Yeah, that idea, Jane, of appropriation, it's one of the big debates around all sorts of stories that are told at the moment. Does it have a particular quality or a particular challenge in the world of dementia, as Jan has described it there?
I think it does. And I think you touched on it there, Sean, when you said about the fact that, dementia, in a way, it defies narrativization. And the symptoms coming together, they mean a loss of memory often. And you need memory to write a narrative, or at least the very basic definition of a narrative is a series of events in time. And that's quite difficult to compose without a memory. So there's also issues to do with the sense of identity and self that can be affected with dementia. And we need that for someone to be able to tell a story. So if those two things break apart, what you've got is a paradox in your hands. How do you tell the story of dementia if the storyteller is unable to tell stories anymore, you know? So it does present a really interesting case study for appropriation and for telling someone's story.
Yeah, and that's part of what struck me, that poetry might be particularly useful in that respect, because poetry maybe isn't bound by the kind of narrative rules that a novel might be bound by. The second part of the project, Jane, was the formation, are these reading groups that were set up. What exactly was involved there?
Okay, so most of the time in my field, we write up analyses of literature, and it sits on a dusty shelf, and we presume that language has these effects, and that's our idea of it, and there it goes, that's it. What I decided with this was I wanted to see if the effects that we would see in the text, so if this mind style is real for real readers, do people actually feel like these kinds of texts give them access to the mind of a person with dementia? Do they feel like they can learn from it? Can awareness be increased? Are these literary representations realistic according to people who have lived through it or with it? So that was the purpose of the reading groups. It was really to take the research and to test if what I see in there is actually there, making literature studies empirical, really. So we held reading groups with people living with dementia, with informal caregivers as well, and a group of the general public, and also trainee social workers to see the effect on them too. So they were held earlier this year, and we're still working on the analysis, but really, really interesting stuff. We'll be talking about it at the festival.
Those are some of the topics. I presume you'll be sharing some of those thoughts of those reading groups with people as the festival progresses.
Absolutely.
Jan Carson, you're the outreach officer for the festival. That's your, I suppose, your official title in terms of. So what kind of outreach projects have you been involved in?
So it's mostly taking what the academics do and making it accessible to real people.
Into ordinary talk.
Yeah. And so this festival is a really unique opportunity. We're bringing together the academics. People who are actually living with dementia themselves are involved in the events. Writers like myself in theatre, poetry, prose, YA and kids fiction, who are all wrestling with these big questions. Carers, umbrella organisations. So it's kind of a celebration, but also an opportunity to have these conversations and to learn from each other. And I think it's unique. We don't know of anywhere else in the world that's bringing all those groups together.
The other thing that strikes me about it, Jane, I said it in the introduction, you know, with this increased diagnosis of dementia. To what extent do you think there is actually an increase in diagnosis? Is it just that our diagnostic tools are better now? And is that what has led to this, it being such an important theme in terms of literature in recent times?
It's a good question. I think our population is aging. So that's one major factor in the increased diagnosis. As you mentioned, it might be something to do with that medics are more conscious of it and ready to diagnose. But it is on the rise. And at the moment, there isn't a cure. So all of our research funds need to be put towards that. But on the other hand, in the humanities and social sciences, what we can do is to help better understand it. And I think that's what the arts and culture is there for. It's to help us understand it, improve awareness, and help us talk about it in a way that's not full of fear.
Yeah, and I suppose that's to put the question the other way around then to you, Jan Carson, as we finish up. Do you feel that, you know, is it? Am I imagining this increase of books and films and programmes that are dealing with dementia as a topic or as a theme? Or is it actually there? And if so, why do you think it's there?
I think it is there, yes. And for all those reasons that Jane mentioned, the ageing population, more awareness, you know, writers feeling more comfortable to talk about these issues. But I honestly think, Sean, we need more. There's such a lack of diversity is one of the big things I find. I've really struggled in those texts to find any ethnic diversity, very little class diversity. You know, your typical dementia character is an old, white, middle-aged lady. And dementia is much, much more complicated and nuanced than that. So we want to see writers wrestling with all the different kinds of dementia and all of the different ways it appears so that folks can pick up a text or turn on the TV or go to a play and see a little bit of their own story reflected.
Yeah, so you want to facilitate and encourage the diversity, not just in terms of different types of dementia, but in the stories that are being told.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of breaking news, but the other outcome from this project is we will be publishing an anthology of 14 newly commissioned short stories about dementia next year.
Well, looking forward to hearing those and seeing those and possibly speaking to you closer to the time when that publication comes out. But in the meantime, thanks to Jan Carson and Jane Lochia. The Dementia Fiction Festival takes place 15th and 16th of September, in person and online. Entry is free. Booking is required. You can find out full details on accidentaltheatre.co.uk.